All right, well, I'm going to turn things over to Robert now. Robert is the McIntyre Chair of History and Philosophy. He's been with us on faculty here for about 8 years. Great insights into things related to our faith that cross over with the history and philosophy of science. So I won't steal any more of Robert's thunder. I'll just get his presentation rolling up here for him. And why don't we give him a welcome as he comes in.
Thank you, Rod. I typically am sitting where you're sitting in terms of our ASA meeting, so it's actually fun and I'm honored to be able to actually speak this evening. So what I want to do is talk a little bit about, here you can see the title, God in Action, a Trinitarian Approach to Creation and Science. I want to speak a little bit about the doctrine of creation and, in particular, talk a little bit about and think about some implications of the fact that we actually should be thinking about the doctrine of creation from a Trinitarian perspective, because after all, God is three in one. Right? That's one of our key Christian beliefs. Now, when I typically talk with people about the doctrine of creation, whether it's my students or I'm talking in various churches or whatever, I find that people basically in the evangelical world, if you ask them what is the doctrine of creation, they will basically tell you two things. One is that God created ex nihilo, created out of nothing, which is an important feature of our theological understanding of God's relationship to creation. There isn't pre-existent matter that God takes to somehow manipulate and turn into what he wishes to fashion it into. He actually creates matter and space and time and all of the other things you need for our creation. So that's one feature pretty much everybody has a handle on. And the other is that God did it. God created it in 6 days, but you might not actually have a good, clear idea about what in the world 6 days means, right? We have a range of understandings on that as a Christian community. And if I ask, well, is there anything else about the doctrine of creation? This is sort of, you know, head-scratching or, you know, chinning and things like that, say, no, I think that's about it. Right. But actually, historically speaking, there is a lot more to the doctrine of creation. And indeed, some of the things I'll be drawing on, we can find going all the way back to Irenaeus and some of the other early Christian pastor theologians. So what I want to do is talk a little bit about a kind of fuller understanding of the Trinitarian nature of the doctrine of creation, and then think with you a little bit about how I think that helps us to understand more about basically putting the sciences, scientific results in perspective, and I'll talk a little bit about cosmology as the kind of the exemplar for that. All right, so the first point that I want to think a little bit about with you is that God's action in creation is mediated. Now, this word mediation, we often think of that, oh, that's when, you know, two parties are having a conflict and, you know, somebody sits down in between them, helps them, you know, mediate the conflict, right? Helps them to get across whatever sort of obstacles that they're facing. And that's one sense of the word mediation, but the sense here that theologians talk about is that God's actions in creation are shaped by or take place through something. And theologians have identified three different sorts of ways that God's activity is mediated. The first one is actually very familiar to us, divine command or divine word. Right? We see that immediately in Genesis 1. And God said, and various sorts of things happen. And God said, various sorts of things happen. And God said, various sorts of things happen. Right? And that theme is actually carried on throughout the New Testament, where there's a linkage between God's command on the one hand and creation on the other hand. And we also see it occur in various sorts of ways in the New Testament as well. So that's something that we're actually pretty familiar with. The second means of mediated action that theologians have talked about is through the Son and the Spirit. So Irenaeus used the image of God's two hands. The Spirit is one hand, the Son is another hand. Not to mean that somehow the hands are doing independent things of the Father. It's always Father, Son, and Spirit working in unity. But they also are working in terms of a different, carrying out different kinds of functions in creation. Not unlike the way in which we talk about Father, Son, and Spirit carrying out specific kinds of roles in terms of salvation and sanctification. So we actually have a number of verses in the Bible that we can start to look at that talk about things that, say, the Son is doing. So just a couple of them that I have up here on the slides from Colossians 1:16. For by him, Jesus, all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible. Same sort of thing that one sees in John chapter 1, verse 3. Through him, through the Son, all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. Right. So clearly one thing that we can see in terms of the discussion of the New Testament is that everything is created through the Son. And that really is everything. It includes everything that's been created today, right? So any new lives that have been created today, anything that's been created today has in some fashion been created through the Son. But as well, we see a lot of things that clue us in that the Spirit is involved in creation too. So think about Genesis 1, the first two verses, right? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. Right? That Hebrew word that's translated Spirit there is Ruach, which can mean has a variety of meanings, wind, breath, spirit, and you see various people drawing on all three of those senses when they interpret or translate the Hebrew word in various passages, whether it's here in Genesis or its appearance in Psalm 104 and other sorts of places. Now, in terms of the original audience who would have been hearing Genesis 1 read in the synagogue, say, they would not necessarily have thought, aha, Father, Son, and Spirit, that, you know, cool. They don't really know anything about God's Trinitarian nature, right? That's something that is unfolded for us in the New Testament. So it's in light of the New Testament when we go back and look at a passage like this in Genesis 1, the theologians begin to say that, well, that hovering over the waters, the breath or spirit of God hovering over the waters, that's the presence of the Holy Spirit, right? Psalm 104, when you send your spirit, they are created, you renew the face of the earth. There are a number of ways in which theologians talk about how, when you see various sorts of passages that talk about waters and rivers, that's connected with or images for the Spirit's work in terms of renewing and healing. Water is often associated with images of life, and the Spirit is the giver of life. We actually have that enshrined in one of our creeds. Right in the Nicene Creed, we believe in the Holy Spirit, the Lord, the giver of life, who proceeds from the Father and the Son. Right, so there's a wealth of things that we could sort of go into depth there in terms of thinking about what sorts of roles does the Son have, what sorts of roles does the Spirit have, how are they ministering in creation in ways that carry out the Father's will, such that all three members of the Trinity, right, are working in unity. The third form of ministerial action or mediated action that is identified by theologians is a kind of ministerial form. It's a means through which God has enabled creation to participate in its own creation, or God has empowered creation to be able to participate in or minister to creation. So God actually works through the processes of creation in order to bring about plans and purposes, accomplish things in creation. Now this is a means of mediation that, for the most part, that is typically unknown to us. We don't really think much about this. But actually, when you look at the text and begin to think about things, you see that actually this shows up all over the place in the Bible. And actually it shows up from the get-go in Genesis 1, although we aren't really used to reading Genesis 1 and seeing this there. So, for example, Genesis 1:11, and God said, there's the divine command, let the earth grow grass, plants, and so forth. Right. So there we see that there's something about creation that has been empowered to actually bring forth grass, trees, shrubs, all kinds of different sorts of plants, looking again at, say, Genesis 1:24, and God said, let the earth bring forth. So, and then there's this list of creatures that bring forth, including the creepy crawly things that, you know, bug some of us out, right? All of that is in it, and God pronounces those things good. But notice that over and over again, right, the pattern is something about enabling or calling forth creation to produce, to bring forth. The Hebrew word that is translated bring forth, in reference to things like soil and water, has a range of meanings, but here it actually does mean something like originate. So it's not just that God popped life down and then it keeps it going, but there's actually a participation of soil and earth in originating life, as well as sustaining life, not just merely reproducing life. Right, so it's a great example of seeing that how a creation is actually ministering to creation by helping to produce life, and that's a means through which things are created by Christ, as the Spirit enables brings about life. Another image that one can think about, for instance, is we know that in the Book of Numbers, we're told that Moses built the tabernacle. But when one looks earlier at the discussion in Numbers and in Exodus, we know that it wasn't Moses who was gathering all the materials and sewing stuff together and dyeing the various skins, tanning them, cutting the poles, casting the molds for all the gold rings and the pomegranates and all these other things that are discussed in detail right in the biblical texts. Moses built the tabernacle through the means of lots of gifted artisans and other sorts of gifted individuals who carried out a variety of different roles, right, to make it possible to have both the materials, the fashioning of the materials, and then ultimately the building of the tabernacle, right? But the Bible clearly attributes to Moses the building of the tabernacle, while understanding that that attribution, what it implies, is that he built it through the means of other people. Right? So this pattern of somehow people, particularly God, working through means of creation to actually bring about creation is something that you'll see sort of everywhere. So when one thinks about this Trinitarian involvement in creation, we should actually think along the lines that it's not only happening at the origin of all things, right? We think of Genesis 1, we think about the origin of the universe, we think about the origin of the earth, we think about the origin of life, so on and so forth. But it's actually also in the ongoingness of creation, because creation is still taking place today. Babies were born today. Life was conceived today, not only in humans, but in all kinds of creatures. Various sorts of plants, somewhere in the world, were pollinated. Maybe not around here, right? It's not the right time right here, but somewhere in the world, pollination took place today, right? All of those things are ongoing creation that involve carrying out the purposes and plans of the Father, created through the Son, enabled by the Spirit, and creation is a kind of key player along with God in the bringing about of these things in creation. So creation just isn't a past event, it's an ongoing event, and God is still intimately involved in that. And sometimes we forget that too when we're thinking about creation. We sometimes fall into what I call a kind of practical deism. So God creates, starts everything off, and then it just kind of runs automatically. Birds and the bees do what the birds and the bees do, right? And on it goes, right? Without our thinking that, oh, wait a minute, God's still involved in that. God is still directing, guiding, enabling, sustaining all of those kinds of activities. So Christ is still creating today. Another aspect to think about with this is that God acts patiently in creation. Now, what do I mean by that? I don't mean that God sort of sitting around twiddling divine thumbs, whatever that might be, waiting for, say, mountains to rise up to the point where you say, okay, now I can get to work on doing something because the mountains have gotten tall enough. Right? See, it's a couple of pictures of various sort of features of the Alps. I have on many occasions asked students to guess what they're looking at here. The mountain you see on the right-hand side is actually the Matterhorn, but from the Italian side. So it's a great test as people are looking. Sort of, what is that? It's a fantastic mountain. When one looks at sort of features like this, the other pictures are the Glarus overthrust, where you've got older crust being thrust over younger crust. And these processes of mountain building and the overthrusting, they take place at about, on average, 1 to 2 millimeters a year. 1 to 2 millimeters a year. Now, if you want to do the math, right, you can think about 1 to 2 millimeters a year. I mean, how long does it take, 1 to 2 millimeters a year, to get something that's the height of the Matterhorn, which is also acting against erosion, which is tending to actually take away material from the mountains, right? Well, so you do the math, and that's a long time. Right? So Dr. Mosier, our resident geologist, could actually tell you, lots of things about those processes. But the point here is that it's not like God's waiting around for the Alps or any other mountains to get to a particular height and say, okay, now I'm ready to go to work. The idea rather is that just like we saw in Genesis 1, God said, let the earth bring forth, and that bringing forth is a means by which God is working to bring forth life. God's also working through the processes of creation to bring forth mountains. We're talking about millions and millions of years, right, to produce a mountain range that has all these spectacular features about it that we get very excited about. Every day, every 1 to 2 millimeters a year, right, God is intimately involved in those processes of creation. This idea that God is creating in space and time is something that actually is a very important feature that when you begin to look at the biblical record, you begin to see that God exercises tremendous kinds of patient action. Right now, we used to think about patient action in terms of our lives. I mean, God pursues us with a love that reaches across time to bring us to himself. Right? And we're very thankful for that kind of thing. But it's also the case that God is pursuing in a loving way, the building of creation to bring it to some kind of final consummation or completion in Christ that we await to see. This idea of God acting patiently in creation is intimately tied in with the idea that there is this kind of ministerial means through which God is acting in creation. When we think about things like the production of life, whether it's gestation period of average of 9 months for human beings, or whether it's the slow growth of redwood trees, or whether it's something like the mountains, we should begin to think about, that's God acting patiently and intimately within creation. God's not really in a rush. We are, because we're trained to have to think in terms of microwave categories, right? Be able to microwave our dinner and so forth, right? So the microwave minute, even now, feels like it's a little too long, right? You really wish that you could have your food warmed up in 5 seconds rather than a minute or whatever your microwave takes. Well, that's a problem with us, right? That's a commentary on us and how we think about things, how we are concerned about time and so on and so forth. But instead, God has a very different kind of perspective than us. And we should begin to think about the fact that space and time are the arenas within which God acts patiently. As in Psalm 139:13, you created my inmost parts, wove me in my mother's womb, right? 9 months, that's a lot of patient weaving, right? And when David is writing this psalm, he's fully aware that there's something about the human body that is participating, right, in this process of weaving in the womb. So it's not like God's doing something apart from the anatomy of human beings at this point. He doesn't understand those processes. We know a whole lot more about those processes. We could write our own Psalm 139 with a different kind of detailed discussion, right, of how it is that God is weaving us in the in the womb sort of flesh out, the kind of patient activity that is represented by the biological processes that are means through which God is creating. So it actually is biblically legitimate to say that God made you and me. God made each child. Each one of us were created through Christ, but in such a way that creation is intimately involved in that as well. All right. Now, given this kind of framework. Well, I guess I should say one other thing about this. So this idea that God is active in creation, we also want to keep in mind that it's not just, God in a kind of monistic sense, right? The idea of thinking about the fact that it's Father, Son, and Spirit involved in creation means that we begin to unfold things such as when creation is acting, it's not acting on its own, but indeed, its ability to actually participate in the bringing about of other things in creation takes place under the superintendence of the Son. Right? It doesn't happen off over here and the Son's doing something else. And it also involves the enablement of the Spirit. The Spirit plays one of the roles of this idea, or one way to read this idea of the fluttering of the, or hovering over the waters in Genesis 1. Is that perhaps is indicating or representing something about how it is that the Spirit energizes and enables creation to become all that it is called to be in Christ. So that ultimately it really does become what the Father is calling it to be and fulfills the plans and purposes that Father, Son, and Spirit have for it. All right, so there's some theology. Some pretty heavy theology, and gone over in a fairly quick sort of way. And what I want to do now is to sort of step back for a moment and think a little bit about how it is that thinking about Trinitarian action that is patient, that involves the Son and the Spirit in creation, and it always involves creation itself, how does that perhaps help us to think about the sciences, because it doesn't take, I think, anybody too long who's either a Christian or a non-Christian, when they think about, how is it that Christians in the church and the sciences relate, that this doesn't always go well, right? We all are probably aware that we bump into various kinds of tensions with what to do about the sciences on the one hand and our understanding of Christian faith and our attempts to live out our faith authentically on the other hand. So here's one suggestion that I have. Instead of thinking about scientific theories as supposedly being offered up as alternatives to God's action in creation, perhaps we should think about scientific theories as possible candidates for giving us some descriptions about how it is that God is normally at work in creation. If this idea of ministerial means of God acting through creation to bring about creation is on the mark, then the kinds of things that scientists are studying, whether they're chemists or physicists or geologists or what have you, that really is more about, or we can think about it more as being their attempts to describe and offer explanations for the normal ways that God is working in creation. And these ordinary means by which creation becomes what it is called to be in Christ is actually enabled by the Spirit. Which is not to say that you can look in a microscope or look through a telescope and see, oh, I see the Spirit there. Spoiler alert. Empirical methods that the scientists engage in are not designed to see those kinds of things. They're designed to do something very mundane, basically see how it is that various sorts of pieces of physical reality interact with other pieces of physical reality, so we get things like grass growing. for instance, and changes of the seasons, and so on and so forth. Right? So the sciences really are aimed at what I often will tell students are very mundane kinds of questions. They aren't designed to tell us about the meaning of life, or you know what purposes you know all of creation is for, so on and so forth. They're somewhat blind to those kinds of things, and that's okay, right? Because we shouldn't be looking to the sciences to inform us about things like you know how should I live and what is the meaning of life, because they aren't designed to answer those kinds of questions. They can give us some input into those questions, but. The Bible and life in the spirit, that's where we understand what purpose is and what the meaning of life is, and begin to come to an understanding of what God might be up to in the world, so on and so forth. Right. So when I say that scientists focus on sort of the ordinary means by which God is working in creation to enable creation to become all that it's called to be in Christ, that... one should take that pretty literally, right? Pretty straightforwardly. It's about how things like electrons, protons, and neutrons interact with each other, and how it is that gravity works, and what enables things like the bonding that produces oxygen, for instance, and the other kinds of molecules that we need to have life supported, so on and so forth. Those are the kinds of things that scientists can study and can tell us a whole lot about. But the idea is that when they are telling us about those sort of things, they're actually giving us possible descriptions of the means by which God is working to, say, make life possible. Alright, so let me give some examples of this by thinking about cosmology. Partly because cosmology is cool. Pretty fun stuff, but also because it illustrates very nicely, I think, ways in which we can think theologically using the doctrine of creation and sort of enrich our understanding of what's going on in the sciences. Right. So, this lovely verse that actually appears in a couple of spots in Isaiah and in Psalm 104, it stretches out the heavens like a canopy, spreads them out like a tent to live in. That is a wonderful, sort of very poetic way of talking about, you know, things like the expansion of space, the spreading of the stars and galaxies, so on and so forth. Right. So we could talk a lot about that. We could talk about ex nihilo creation because ex nihilo creation, as some of you probably are aware, is the kind of thing that looks to be consistent. With our current sort of Big Bang understanding, which is kind of all compressed in this picture that you see here, with sort of Big Bang beginning of the universe, it expands up, galaxies form, and then stars and planets, and so on and so forth. But I don't really want to talk about that either, because that's ground that actually has been trodden a lot. And we have a pretty good understanding that, so the Big Bang is a way in which ex nihilo creation could take place, where you go from nothing to an explosion of something, an explosion of space, time, laws, matter, energy, so on and so forth. That clearly is something we could say from the standpoint of thinking about the doctrine of creation, is a means by which God creates space and time, and then creates within space and time. But I want to focus some comments on things that that you might think of as being a life-affirming universe, right? And for that, I want to talk about just some examples of what we call fine-tuning. So perhaps you've heard this term, fine-tuning. There seem to be features about the universe that are specifically or specially suited to life. And the fact that we have life in the universe. So people have made discoveries over time that there's, you know, that not just that things like the mass of the electron, the mass of the proton, the magnitude of the charge of electrons and protons, the strength of the electromagnetic field, of its interaction, so on and so forth. Not only that these have, you know, interesting, I mean, they have specific values and the numbers might be interesting, or they might look to you as being really odd, but over time we've discovered that actually there seems to be rhyme and reason to these kinds of numbers. That is actually the case. That the odd values that they have, the very sort of specific kind of values they have to be pretty much what they are. If we're going to have a universe with beings like us in it. Right? So let me give you a couple of quick examples. We're all familiar with the fact that electrons and protons are charged particles, and they have equal and opposite charge. That's really good news, because if you were to change the magnitudes of the electron or proton charges, if you were to actually change those a little bit so they're no longer, they can still be opposite, but they're no longer equal to each other, then you can't get the chemistry that we have today. So you can't form things like carbon, which is important to be able to form the long sorts of molecular chains that make the biology that we are based upon actually work. So if you change those magnitudes just slightly, you wouldn't have the bonding properties that chemists know and love, and that makes life possible. So that would be bad news, right? That wouldn't be a life-affirming universe. That's the sense of bad news. The electron mass and the proton mass. So the proton is much heavier than the electron. And at first that seems like an unremarkable fact, until physicists discovered that, well, wait a minute, the exact ratio, the exact difference between the proton mass and the electron mass turns out to be crucial, again, for chemistry to be able to function the way that it does. So if you were to change the mass differences, just change that ratio just by a little bit between the proton and the neutron, then you either would end up with atoms for which all we could do is basically bond and form maybe up to helium, and that would be it. And that doesn't get you to carbon or any of the other sorts of elements that are important for life. If you were to make that mass difference a little bit less, it would be very difficult to actually, for protons to actually capture and hold electrons in the sort of ways in which that they bond with the kinds of properties that we have. That again make it possible for you to have things like carbon and so forth. So changing the mass difference by a little bit would give us a world that doesn't have the right kind of chemistry to support life. Similar story for the basic strength of the electromagnetic interaction. Make it too strong, and protons will not share their electrons with other atoms, so you can't actually form molecules. Make it too weak, and electrons, because they just whiz by too quickly, protons can't hold them, so you can't actually form any sorts of atoms. And again, you can't then bind them together to be able to form compounds like carbon, produce oxygen, make things like water, so on and so forth. So it's, again, not possible for us to have the kind of life-affirming chemistry that we have. And one last example, thinking about the gravitational force. We all know and love the gravitational force. It's what keeps us grounded to the surface of the Earth. Right? So at the moment, you're able to sit comfortably in a chair because gravity is holding you here. And if you ever wondered, well, why don't I fall through my chair? Well, that's the electromagnetic force that keeps you from falling through your chair. So there's a way right there that creation's ministering to you, right? Keeping you grounded on the Earth, but you don't fall through chairs and floors and things like that. But gravity is also important for other kinds of things. If we were to change the gravitation, the basic strength of the gravitational interaction by a little bit, then we also would end up with various sorts of problems. So, for example, if it were any weaker, then it would be very difficult for stars to actually form such that they are hot enough for nuclear fusion processes to start. And we would still have a universe that's almost all hydrogen, a little bit of helium, and a little bit of lithium. And that would be it. Right? So again, stars would not be able to do the kinds of wonderful things they do, that is, manufacture all of the other elements that one needs to be able to build planets, for instance. Now that would be possible if the gravitational reaction were a little bit too weak. If it were a little bit stronger, then we would end up with a kind of catastrophe where everything would come into sort of catastrophic super large black holes. And that's also not a recipe for being able to create the kinds of elements and distribute them in the right sorts of ways so that you could have things like a planetary system that's got an Earth like ours orbiting a sun like ours at at a sweet spot in terms of its habitable zone. So those sorts of things, again, would not be possible. Right? So you can say life is brought to you by very interesting kinds of examples of finely tuned features like these. The mass of the proton and the electron, their charges and the fact that they are equal and opposite, that things like the strength of the gravitational interaction and the electromagnetic interaction, also the strong and weak nuclear interactions to complete the four fundamental forces, all of those things have to be pretty close to the range that we find them in now, or else we don't get the sort of chemistry that enables us to be able to form the kinds of molecules that makes life possible, or you simply can't actually get those molecules constructed. You can't get beyond things like hydrogen and helium. Now, these are some, once you begin to look at that, these sort of mundane and you might think sort of tedious facts, you probably think, well, you know, in high school and college, I had to take these classes and we had to go over all this stuff, and oh man, it was so tedious, and it was kind of boring, and all, you know, it was all these numbers, I'm a scientist, I have to worry about these numbers. Well, that's actually pretty spectacular stuff. When you think about the fact that these numbers that drove you crazy, at least some of you crazy, and maybe bored you to death, turn out to be playing such an important role in making it possible for you to be here, hearing about numbers that used to bore you to death. Right? We can have a lecture like this tonight because we live in a world that actually has the right sort of chemistry that enables the right sort of biology that makes life possible, and that's all brought to you by these wonderful kinds of fine-tunings. But that's simply another way of saying that all of that is brought to you by a creation that is, if you want to say it this way, is designed to minister to creation. Right? So going back to this idea of this ministerial means of God's mediated activity in creation, when we begin to unpack that and look at what it is the scientists have been discovering and have been amazed about, we begin to see that actually these are perhaps examples of how it is that creation ministers to creation, making it possible for life to come to originate and to be sustained over vast amounts of time. This is an example of what I have in mind when I'm saying that if we think richly about the Trinitarian nature of creation and how it is Father, Son, and Spirit are involved in different aspects but all in unity of purpose, and that creation has actually been designed and is being constantly enabled by the Spirit to participate in creation. Then we can begin, we take that perspective, then we can look at what it is the scientists have discovered about our kind of fine-tuned nature of creation, and see that this is a life-affirming universe in lots and lots and lots of ways, And actually, as Christians, we should expect it to be a life-affirming universe. I mean, one of God's purposes is for creation to actually participate in its own coming to be, to participate in producing and sustaining life. And if one of God's purposes it turns out to be, as we can see in the Bible, that creation is to be filled with life, then we would expect that this would be a life-affirming universe. And lo and behold, it looks an awful lot like the sciences have produced a number of results that fit with that expectation. Right? So that's a way in which I want to say that instead of thinking about work that physicists and astronomers are doing is perhaps offering us alternatives to God's work in creation, that actually they might be telling us something about how God is working in creation. Not only how God is working through creation, but maybe something about how exquisitely designed creation is. I mean, if you are planning to have a creation that's going to have life in it, this is pretty much what you would draw up. Once you understood what is required to have life in terms of things like the importance of carbon and water and so on, and then back out, okay, so what kind of physics would make that possible? You're going to get pretty close to sort of what we, the world that we've discovered that we live in. Right? So, in that sense, there is a lot that's actually pretty remarkable about what it is that scientists have discovered. Alright, so, let me go to the next slide. Well, why is it then that both non-Christians and Christians seem to think that when they talk about science, they talk about religion, their first thought seems to be that there's competition, right? Or that somehow the science is trying to replace God. Well, there's actually a history to that. That would be a whole series of talks to sort of go through that history. One important kind of feature is a particular form of a false dilemma which arose in the 18th century that one sees coming to fruition sort of in 18th century deism and is actually still with us today. And the structure is pretty simple. Looks like this, you know. Events, anything that happens in nature, is either the result of God's unmediated intervention, apart from anything about the properties and processes that we are studying in nature, or the result of those natural processes with no divine involvement whatsoever. Right? So it's either somehow all God, apart from creation, or it's all of nature with no God. And those are two pretty unpalatable options when you begin to think about them. But if that is the kind of framework that you are implicitly assuming, then when you look at the sciences, you might say, well, I mean, the sciences are basically telling us about all the things that are going on that, you know, God's not involved in. And they seem to tell us more and more about what's going on. And it looks like, you know, God doesn't really have a job to do anymore once it's all started. And if God doesn't have a job to do, then maybe God's not really necessary. Maybe we don't need a God to start things off. So eventually you can see how you can get from deism under this picture to something like agnosticism or atheism, for instance. On the other hand, for Christians, if we're trapped in this dilemma, anytime somebody tries to tell us that, you claim that God does this, but actually, you know, science has discovered that, you know, X, Y, and Z happen, right? So the more and more that we understand about processes like conception and gestation and birth, so on and so forth, the more and more the scientists may say, well, it's that second horn of the door. You know, it's just the results of natural processes doing their thing, right? There's no room for God. And we get our hackles up because now we feel like, you know, there's a kind of threat going on there, right? That's like there's an attack on God. For some scientists, they want to attack God, right? I mean, most scientists are just saying, hey, we're just studying these processes. That's, you know, what more can I say? The scientists say this. and I don't know what to say about the other stuff. Right, and we get driven into this corner because we think that the only other option is that God somehow is doing things apart from creation, working in these unmediated ways. Right. Well, all right. Now, if we go back and we think about the fact that under this kind of fuller Trinitarian way of thinking about God's activity in creation, that the Son and the Spirit are always involved. As mediators of everything that happens in creation, and that they are working through the very processes and properties of creation to bring about creation, then we can see that actually the reason why this dilemma is false is because it's left out a very important biblical option. Indeed, this dilemma is not biblical, it turns out. And historically, one can see that it actually originated by thinking about, you know, leaving the Bible on the shelf, and how much can we understand about God and creation by just using human reason alone? And, well, that's always a recipe for disaster. Right? Once one turns away from the Bible to think about, well, we can come to the truths about God, but just, you know, applying our unaided minds. Right? Well, if we think, though, about this mediation, these mediational forms through which God is working in creation, then we can see that actually an important option is left off the table, is that any event that happens in creation is both fully the work of God and fully the work of creation. Right? So go back to Psalm 139:13, you wove me in my mother's womb. Right? All of the biological processes are genuinely at work in the ways that we understand them to be working. There's no reason that Christians should deny that. But at the same time, we can see with our theological eyes that God is working through those processes, by means of those processes, superintended by the Son and enabled by the Spirit, all of us came into the world, right? In what I would say is the usual way. If you've come into the world in an unusual way, I'd like to hear about that later. But all of us came into the world in the usual way, and it was both God and creation. Right? It wasn't either God or creation. Right? We're forced into a false choice if these are the only two options that we're given. Right? So one of the payoffs, one of the benefits of thinking about a richer understanding of the doctrine of creation, that's more than just, you know, God created 6 days, whatever that means, and ex nihilo creation, but it actually unfolds for us more about how it is that God works in and through creation. And we can see that this is actually the wrong way to frame things, right? This kind of false dilemma. And if we go back and we think about Genesis 1, we see that actually it's been there all the time. Right? So Genesis 1, 24 through 25. And God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures of each kind, cattle and crawling things and wild beasts of each kind. And it was so. God made wild beasts of each kind and cattle of every kind and all crawling things on the ground of each kind. And God saw that it was good. Right? So we shouldn't look at these two verses and think that, well, gee, either the earth brought it forth or God made it. So which one is it? So is the author or editors of Genesis, are they confused? Are they drawing on two different, you know, sort of religious traditions and trying to mesh them together and they're incompatible? No, that's also a way to think those sorts of things about the text. The sort of the plainest sense of the text available to us is that it's both creation and God that are bringing forth the wild beasts and the creepy crawly things and all of the wondrous stuff in creation. And not only that God is at work in ways that, these verses maybe don't actually fully prepare us for in terms of just the sheer variety of what God is doing in creation. Right? So, think about beetles, for instance. There are at least 400,000 different species of beetle, and there may be as many as a million. We're not sure, right? It's somewhere between 400,000 and a million, right? That's a lot of species of beetle, right? Now, you may like beetles, or you might not like beetles. I mean, they you know, maybe give you the willies like some of the creepy crawly things, right? But just think of just the sheer creativity of all those beetles. And God's saying, that's good. Those refrains about this is good, this is good, this is good, this is good in Genesis, right? I mean, they still continue today because God's still creating all kinds of things. We've got new species showing up over time in creation. All those things are created through Christ. Right? That's what we're told in Colossians and in John 1, so on and so forth. And wherever there's life, there's the ministry and work of the Spirit. Right? And so you could also go look at Psalm 104. In Psalm 104, you see a you see the same pattern in Genesis 1. That virtually every other sentence, it's the waters of the springs that are providing for the sustenance for plants and animals, but it's God who is providing the water that enables plants and animals to live and to fulfill their thirst and so on and so forth. Same sort of thing shows up in Job 38-42, and we can find again the New Testament references that begin to tell us more about how it is the Son and the Spirit are involved in those things, and gives us lenses to be able to expand our ability to see that Father, Son, and Spirit are involved through divine command and also through creation itself, bringing about incredible wonders. And also it's patient wonders, right? So this is another way in which we can, if we think about the fact that God is acting patiently in creation and he's acting through the very processes and properties of creation, then we can think about things like not just the slow building of mountains, but our biologists could give us some sense for, okay, so what are, in terms of, the development of 400,000 to a million species of beetle, how long does that take, given the sorts of processes by which you get diversification going on, so on and so forth. And again, that would be something that we could either say, well, I mean, they're either offering a story that's in competition with God, right? So it's the second half of this false dilemma, just the natural processes, no God involved whatsoever. Or we could think about the perspective that the psalmist has and the author of Genesis 1 and so on, that, well, no, actually, there's some sense in which it's God and creation at work. And creation is a genuine, full-blooded participant. So the processes that scientists are uncovering are giving us a handle on ways in which we can describe not only the genuine properties and processes of creation, but ways in which we can begin to see that God is working through those processes and properties in patient ways to unfold an incredible kind of variety and creativity in creation. And I should say that, again, in contrast to the false dilemma, it's never the case that some sort of process of creation is taking place apart from God. Nothing runs independently on its own in an autonomous fashion. Everything is superintended by the Son and enabled by the Spirit, from quarks and electrons, the smallest things in the universe, up to the entire universe itself. All right, so that's my last slide. That is an indication that I should probably get to my concluding comments. All right, so what I tried to do is talk a little bit about the fact that there's more to the doctrine of creation when we look at the whole sweep of Scripture than what we tend to focus on and hear about in our churches and carry with us in terms of our daily lives. When we begin to unfold a bit more of what that the doctrine of creation is, we begin to see that it actually enriches our ability to turn back and look at creation and see it with new eyes, see it in different ways. And one of those ways is being able to theologically interpret the kinds of results that scientists are involved in. So they discover things like what appear at first to be mundane facts about, well, you know, we got electrons and protons, they got various properties, they got mass of so and so much, and they got a charge like this, and various other sorts of properties. And then you discover, right, that it's in virtue of the specificity, right, the precise nature of those properties, that the chemistry that makes life possible is actually for the world that we live in. The only world that we understand can possibly be, right, in terms of the biology that makes life click. That's dependent upon a particular kind of chemistry, which is dependent upon all these interesting sort of facts that we discovered about electrons and protons and the elementary or fundamental forces, so on and so forth. Right. So if we think about this ministerial perspective, right, the idea that creation is actually designed from the get-go to be ministerial, then the fact that protons and electrons have the specific masses that they do, and have equal and opposite charges, and the strength of the electromagnetic and gravitational interactions are the magnitudes that they are, those are actually examples of how creation is ministering to creation. Because those very specific sort of features that the physicist discovers minister to the chemistry that we study and understand by making it possible for there to be atoms and molecules that bind according to the rules that we have seen. And that in turn, right, that chemistry can be seen as something that ministers to and enables biology to function the way it is. So we can have the kinds of biomolecules that exist so that you can have things like DNA and RNA and have that actually within an appropriate kind of cell structure so that they can do their kind of manufacturing processes for our protons and other sort of our proteins and other sorts of things, so on and so forth. And that biology, right, in turn, ministers to us and to every creature on Earth, because that actually makes it possible for there to be life. Those human beings, or, you know, perhaps a million species of beetle, so on and so forth. Right? That's a very different way of thinking about the sciences. That's a very different way of thinking about what we take to be kind of dry, mundane, fundamental facts about the world, about electrons and protons, and chemistry, and the binding rules for chemistry, and thinking about the biology that we all study in high school and college, which for those who are interested in sciences, that was exciting stuff. For those who aren't interested in the sciences, well, dry. But this makes it less dry to me. When I begin to think about how it is that the spirit is enabling everything from quarks and electrons all the way up to have layer upon layer upon layer of these kind of ministerial relations that ultimately makes life possible, which then enables beings like us to enter into a relationship with God, that suddenly is not so dry. So that is what I want to offer to you tonight in terms of thinking about a richer sort of Trinitarian approach to thinking about the doctrine of creation. And I hope to have given you some sense for how, when we begin to catch that kind of perspective, then we can look at the sorts of things that scientists are doing and see them with new eyes in ways that many scientists don't appreciate. And that's okay. I mean, scientists do what they do. They don't have to appreciate, you know, the sort of the full range and implications, theologically speaking, of everything that they do. We, though, are in a position where we can apply our theological eyes, look at creation, and see that there's a lot more going on that's rich and wonderful than what the scientists typically take into account. Thank you.
I've been asked to moderate tonight. I'm Steve Mosier, and I'd like to open up to questions. We'll just go to a quarter after, and we'll have meet and greet time. So, any yes, Dorothy.
I'll start it off. Thank you, Robert. Wonderful. I appreciate all that you shared with us. I wonder, I noticed in we had conversations about this, this is the normal way that creation works. I wonder if you would comment on what parts of the Trinity are involved in miraculous works.
Good question, because we still want to be able to talk about miracles. Fortunately, we have some help here, because this thing about one of the biggest, most important miracles of all, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. By the way, that was not a plan. It's not like I paid Doc to ask that question. One of you could have asked that question, too, perhaps. But when we start to look at the account that Paul gives in Romans, or what the sort of statements that Peter makes about the resurrection of Christ, they both say the same thing. They say that the Spirit is the one that raised Jesus from the dead. I take it that that pointing to the Spirit does at least two things. One is it's consistent with what we say in the Creed, that the Spirit is the giver of life. So in that sense, there's nothing perhaps surprising about that, because the Spirit is on the scene wherever there is life. But there's also something really important beyond that that I think that Paul and Peter are trying to say, and that's that the Spirit did something that is unusual. The Spirit did something that is not part of the normal operations of creation. So when I go back to this false dilemma, notice this false dilemma is really key to thinking about, you know, the events that happen in nature. Right? How do we explain and understand the sort of the natural, the normal processes that are going on? Miracles begin to enter the game when we have to think about what happens that's outside of the norms, the normal kinds of boundaries for the processes of creation. So far as we know, resurrections are not within that norm. Unless there's something new in biology that you guys have discovered, I don't think that there's anything about resurrections that is within the norms. So this is a place where we can see that one of the implications of the discussion of the Spirit raising Jesus from the dead is that clearly the Spirit has done something, a kind of singular, special kind of event that is an anchor to faith that is actually outside our ability to try to understand what it is that's going on in terms of nature, in terms of the natural processes of creation. So one wants to think about how miracles fit in too, but miracles are the kinds of things that typically are in a separate category from the ordinary ongoingness of creation. But an important thing we should think about that is that whether it's miracles or whether it's the normal, ordinary processes, God is present in all of that. Right? It's not like God's only working in the miracles. Sometimes we as Christians think that way, we feel that way. It's only, God's only present in the miracles and the other stuff, but that's to fall into the false dilemma in terms of thinking about God's relationship to creation. But God is involved in both. All of the ordinary goings on in creation and the extraordinary, the miraculous. So we can actually give praise to God for all things, like the psalmist when he says we should give praise for the fact that that grass is growing. It's in there. Look, Psalm 104, it's in there. One of the great works of God, grass growing. We can literally give thanks to God for all of the great things He's doing, both spectacular miracles like the resurrection and grass growing.
I've heard multiple times that the cosmological constant is fine-tuned to one part in 10^122, I think is what I've heard. You talked about a number of things, if they were a little different, and if they were a little different, and if they were a little different. If you put all of these together, what is the latest understanding of one part and how many, if you put all of these things, multiplied all of these things together?
That's a little bit of a difficult question, because you have to sort through when does it make sense to sort of multiply different sort of physical facts together, when it doesn't. But sorting through all of that, if you were to start to sort of think about, well, what are the odds that everything would be just like this list as we see it for the universe, then the odds are almost hard to imagine. The numbers in terms of what the probability would be if you were just going to poof something, you know, by chance is the way to say it, into existence, right? Then the odds would be they're astronomical. But it's also the case that the odds of my stepping right where I just stepped at this moment in time in that particular location are almost incalculable. Right. But I intentionally stepped right there, right at that moment. Right. So that's how we know, for at least cases like that, that those huge probabilities that somehow purpose and intentionality was involved. We as Christians, I think, look typically at the same way when we see these, you know, sort of as the astronomical odds that you get all of these properties to be just, you know, basically in these very tight, narrow ranges that enable life. The odds on that are, you know, astronomical. But we also turn to our Bibles and say that, well, I mean, they clearly proclaim that God is creator, so that intentionality and purpose tells us why it is events that look so improbable are actual. Right? But those numbers are huge. Which is why honest atheists like Fred Hoyle said that, you know, it certainly looks like the universe was designed by a designer for life. That's troubling to me as an atheist. We should worry about that problem. So there is, you know, if one's open to it, there is some pressure, right, towards the fact that the universe seems to be designed.
Any questions? Yeah. More and more in my old age, I think there may be issues understanding the relationship between religion and science. How often it's a linguistic issue of applying language from one category of thought to another and the problems there. So I want to question you about one of the terms you use that I don't know if it worries me. I'm just kind of trying to figure it out. When you talk about creation being ministerial, I mean, it's a nice religious term, but it seems to imply some kind of agency. So a creation is ministering to creation, God's creative activity. Are you ascribing to nature some kind of agency that would imply perhaps more than you really want to?
So, good question. I'm obviously using the term minister in a much more generalized sense. That sometimes draws upon our human sense of ministry where we reach out and help one another, because that can actually be a helpful metaphor for beginning to think about the fact that, well, creation does all kinds of things to help us, namely keeps us alive, for instance. But not because, you know, molecules have intention to say, oh, man, Blair needs to be alive today, so we need to make this and this and this and give it to him, right? They just do what they do. They actually do what they are purposed and designed to do. And that's sort of the beauty of thinking about the fact that all of creation has this kind of ministerial nature to it, or you can think of it in terms of the kind of functional integrity it has. All of the functionality, the regularities in creation, from the smallest up to the largest, work together in such a way that they actually create these sort of habitable zones like our solar system lives in, at least one of them has life on it. Maybe there are others, we don't know, but this one does have life on it. When I think about things like, well, physics actually ministers to chemistry by making that possible, it makes the biology we have today possible, it makes life possible, I'm not intending to imply any sort of intentionality there. I'm actually talking about the way in which the functionality seems to be pointed or aimed at, it almost looks like it's teleological, right? Being it's to give you the willies about, you know, could this, you know, if, particularly if you're not a believer, right? Then, you know, could this all be intentionally designed such that it fulfills a kind of purpose that's aimed at life because there's something special about what God has in mind for life? But not in the sense that protons are going around thinking, I need to, you know, get together some other protons and some electrons and make carbon. That doesn't happen.
What kind of agency is it if it's not? It's not an intentional agency. What way does it minister if it's not, if you're not imputing an intentionality to it?
So that's where you have to think. That's where you have to think in a more generalized way about ministry, as in ways in which there are benefits that the scientists typically won't see that as benefit, right? But we're bringing an interpretation to that based upon our broader theological understanding.
I like to think of, I think it helps me to think of the creation as saying, okay, well, God has something in mind that he wanted to happen at some point, and so he wanted there to be a mountain at that point in time, that looked like that. And then, since he's outside of time, he just does whatever it takes, however far back into the past that it took to get that to happen. So that's teleology, really, that God has, okay, I want this to happen at this point, and it could have happened, it could have a ripple effect backwards in time in order for it to end up the way he wants it to be at that time. It just helps me, I don't know if you like that perspective or not, to say how God works. Or you say, he's way back there planning this for so long, you know, and because he's outside of time, it really doesn't make sense to start.
Yeah, so one can think along the lines of, okay, so God, you know, sort of figures out, I need creation to get to here, so I'll actually design the sorts of properties and give the right initial conditions to do that. For instance. So maybe. I mean, people have thought along those lines for centuries in various sorts of ways. But it's also the case that, if God, but here's an alternative way to think about it. If God has as one of his purposes that creation generally participates in its own coming to be, which sounds more like it gets a limited, some form of freedom to participate in that, then it's not maybe so much that God says, okay, so I want the Alps to be at about this height at about this particular time, so I'll set the process up so that it happens, but rather that God actually participates with creation so that it becomes what he calls it to be in a way that is perhaps not unlike how the Spirit is at work enabling us through sanctification to become more and more like Christ, but not in a way where it's deterministic, autonomous, kinds of machines. Machines, automatons, that simply, the right sort of spiritual starting condition here will mean that we, spiritually arrive at this point here, but we still have some kind of participatory agency in that as human beings. And perhaps creation has a kind of limited version of that going on in terms of the, and theologians will speak of creation's limited freedom to try to demarcate it from the sort of freedom that we as human beings have. So, and Christians have divided on how much sort of genuineness or freedom does creation have versus how sort of almost more sort of machine-like is it?
Ron, last question.
I really appreciated this. I love this last slide here. And
this slide or the one that's actually after it?
Well, yeah.
I mean, that's the last slide. With all of
the horses. Well, I guess what I'm thinking is that I appreciate that God, the Trinity, have all been involved in creation. And as far as trying to distinguish what each member of the Trinity did in this creation, ongoing creation, it seems to me that's beyond us. That, for example, just talk about prayers or talk about things that happen in our lives where you happen to run into someone of the opposite gender, and you have all kinds of coincidences that somehow just seem to be bringing you together, like God is bringing this person to you. And especially as you get older and you look back on this woman or this man and how they've changed you, how they've done things for you that you never would have anticipated. And so, to me, that is, it would seem like, you know, the Holy Spirit. And I could say, okay, well, God was the part of the Trinity that provided the original, mass and materials and forces and electrical and everything else. But Christ, I keep coming back to, I don't think of Christ as a creator. I think of him as the part of the Trinity that sacrificed itself, himself. And I don't see where you would, for example, position Christ in creation. So, if you could answer some of that, I don't know.
Let me just say quickly, since we're pushing on time here, the biblical picture is Christ is creator and redeemer. And these are things that you cannot separate.
Okay.
So when you start digging into the scriptures, you see that, well, actually, there are a lot of these parallels about, you know, creation, salvation, sanctification. And anytime you begin to pull those apart, then we get into trouble, like deism, for instance, or Gnosticism, or other things like that. But the Gospel of John, right? It begins by telling us that all things are created through Christ, but also tells us about the fact that Christ is the Redeemer of all things that he's made. And, get this, in the first chapter, it talks about the fact that Christ actually, the Son of God actually became incarnated in the very stuff that he made, right? And comes into that which he has made in order to redeem that which he has made. So you have to think about the incarnation, too, right? About the very one who actually made all things in terms of his incarnate form was made in the usual way, right? Knitted together in about 9 months in Mary's womb, and then grew and developed in the rest of the normal ways, right? In terms of, a family, community, whatever education processes, and so on and so forth. And then eventually, right, lived the life that we couldn't live, died the death we all deserve to die, so that when he was raised by the Spirit, our destinies could be basically anchored to his destiny. Right? So that's the kind of creator that the Bible's actually talking about, a creator who makes all things and is in the process of redeeming and completing all things. So that's, I think, is the way you want to think about it. And the incarnation is important for trying to understand, okay, so how is it that Christ, the Son, can actually enter in to that which he has made in order to take the process of redemption and bring it to all that he has made.
Thank you.
Thanks. Join us for cookies and beverages upstairs. Thank you all for coming tonight. Thank you.